For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. So we began our practice period yesterday with an all-day sitting. This evening we've entered our Shuso Keizan, who's come all the way from Albuquerque to be with us for these 2 months. This ceremony we did tonight is very auspicious. It's the third time we've done it, and it's kind of recognized as being auspicious, so much so that the Chicago Cubs, like last year, and given what happened last year, decided to schedule their home opener on the same night as our Shuso entry ceremony again, like last year. So, we know it's an auspicious ceremony. So thank you for coming from Albuquerque, kids. So, whether or not you're formally doing this practice period, we're going to be talking about these teachings from Cultivating the Empty Field from our great ancestor Hongzhe Zhangzhui from the 1100s, who talked about serene illumination, and we need that now. So this is these are teachings, poetic teachings about settling and opening and allowing ourselves to be fully present and to deepen our practice, but also to find ways to be more fully responsive to the world around us. So Hongzhe was a Chinese teacher who also lived in turbulent times in the Song period, where there was civil war, and he spent much of his life living up in the mountains in his monastery. But people came from lay people also came up to the monastery to listen to him, and he number of times emptied the monastery stores to help support the people who were struggling with famine and so forth due to civil wars down below. I want to talk again about for the people in the practice period. There are six. There in these practice instructions in cultivating the empty field. There are 56 different paragraphs or little practice instructions, all of which kind of give different viewpoints of this illuminated serenity that Hongzhe talks about. But we've picked out six of them for people in the practice period to focus on. And again, for those of you not formally in the practice period, you're welcome to enjoy this also. I talked about the first of these yesterday in the practice period, and I want to in the all-day sitting, and I want to talk about it again today. And maybe I'll just read the whole thing. They're not very long, and I'll talk about parts of it. It starts with the practice of true reality, which I want to come back to. But he says the practice of true reality is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. When you have fathomed this, you cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. This empty, wide-open mind is subtly and correctly illuminating, spacious and content, without confusion from inner thoughts of grasping. Effectively overcome habitual behavior and realize the self that's not possessed by emotions. You must be broad-minded, whole, without relying on others. Such upright, independent spirit can begin not to pursue degrading situations. Here you can rest and become clean, pure, and lucid. Bright and penetrating, you can immediately return, accord, and respond to deal with events. Everything is unhindered, clouds gracefully floating up to the peaks, the moonlight glitteringly flowing down mountain streams. The entire place is brightly illumined and spiritually transformed, totally unobstructed and clearly manifesting responsive interaction, like box and lid or arrow points meeting. Continuing, cultivate and nourish yourself to enact maturity and achieve stability. If you accord everywhere with thorough clarity and cut off sharp corners without dependence on doctrines like the white bull or wildcat, helping to arouse wonder, which is a reference from the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, then you can be called a complete person. So we hear that this is how one on the way of non-mind acts, but before realizing non-mind, we still have great hardship. So I want to come back and just touch on a few parts of this, and then have some discussion and comments and responses. But I want to start with this practice of true reality. He says the practice of true reality is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. And we talked about this a little bit in the discussion yesterday afternoon, and I wonder if Hongzhi, and when he's talking about the practice of true reality, maybe was anticipating alternative facts as opposed to true reality. The characters literally mean genuine reality and practicing genuine reality. So what is this genuine reality and how do we practice it? And, to put the adjective there, genuine reality, maybe it's just a way of emphasizing, yes, this. But maybe it's also acknowledging the complexity of reality, the multiplicity of reality, that reality is not one thing, or it's not whatever one thing we think it is. And it's not about figuring it out. So this isn't, even though there are embedded in these practice instructions the dialectical philosophy of ultimate in particular and the 5 degrees of the Shaodong or Soto school, and which are expressed in the harmony of difference and sameness and the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. We can talk about that philosophy, but really he's talking about the practice, and he's talking about how it's expressed in the world. So all of these nature metaphors, the clouds gracefully floating up to the peaks, the moonlight glitteringly floating down mountain streams. He's talking about what is this genuine reality? What is this intricate, complex, not alternative reality, but this full, whole, genuine reality, and how do we practice it? What is this? He says this is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. So this is the practice we do here. We sit and turn and face the wall, face ourselves, turn the light to shine within. We can't practice genuine reality by searching through all of the libraries or all of the news articles or all of, not that, we shouldn't be informed, and not that we can't benefit sometimes from studying. In fact, here we are studying the words of the great ancient masters and so forth. And we could look at philosophers from all kinds of cultures and traditions, but how do we turn and look at our own practice of reality? What does it mean to be the being on your seat right now? Silent introspection. Of course, when we stop and turn and face the wall and face ourselves, you know, often there's lots of chatter. We know that. But still, serenely within that, when we look within. So there's this introspection, it implies this attention, paying attention. It doesn't have to be a military intention, attention. It's just, what's going on? What's happening here? What is this genuine reality? To actually, you know, look at this, to question this. Introspection maybe implies a question, but it's not a question that's about finding some doctrine or philosophy that will explain it all. But he says then when you have fathomed this, so to fathom it, to get to the bottom of this, when you have dug into this, doesn't mean we have some final solution either, but just, he says, then you cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. He doesn't say ignore external causes and conditions. This empty, wide-open mind is subtly and correctly illuminating. So, this empty, wide-open mind. Kaz Ta-Nehisi is going to be here next month, has translated the Heart Sutra and translated Form and Emptiness. He's translated emptiness. He did this translation with Joan Halifax where he translated emptiness as boundlessness, which is really interesting. And I resisted it when I first heard that, but the more I think about it, you know, it's emptiness is not nothingness, but when we talk about form and emptiness in the Heart Sutra, it's, you know, form as specific. You know, not just material, the forms of thoughts and feelings and sensations too, but then the quality of their being open, empty. We could say empty, but then, you know, you have to translate this word empty. It doesn't mean vacant, it means open, boundless. I think it's a good translation maybe, or it's a provocative translation. Anyway, here Hongzhi says, this empty, wide-open mind is subtly and correctly illuminating, spacious and content without confusion from inner thoughts of grasping. You know, and then he talks about overcoming our habitual behavior, not being possessed by emotions. So yeah, we've all got that. We've all got that stuff, that those karmic patterns, personal and communal of greed, hate, delusion, so forth. We all have those human emotional stuff. A little further along, he says, we can immediately return, accord, and respond to deal with events. So the point of this communing with genuine reality, practicing genuine reality, is how can we accord. How can we find communion? How can we find meeting to respond, to deal, to meet and respond to events, to the situation of our life and our world? How do we meet our life? So again, the practice, not the theory, not the abstraction, not the philosophy, but the actual practice, the engagement with genuine reality, starts at least from simply sitting serenely in silent introspection. Doing this practice of upright sitting, we can find some creative energy, we may not be able to articulate the way Hongzhi does. Hongzhi has been, you know, was this brilliant meditation teacher. So this is actually meditation teaching in some way. He's showing us how to settle on our seat. So we cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. Doesn't mean we ignore them. or deny them, but we don't need to get upset. We can actually face the world. We don't have to get depressed. We don't have to get angry. Or when we feel the anger, we don't have to be turned around by that either. When we feel the sadness, we don't have to be turned around by that either. A little further on, he says, continuing, cultivate and nourish yourself to enact maturity and achieve stability. Well, that little sentence is our life work. Continuing. How do we continue this practice of genuine reality? How do we sustain the engagement with genuine reality? Cultivate and nourish yourself. So, that word nourish is important. How do we take care of ourselves? How do we be kind to ourselves? How do we cultivate ourselves to, what do they say? Be all that you can be? How do we do that? How do we continue to enact maturity and achieve stability? So stability doesn't mean being frozen, okay? It means a kind of steadiness where we can continue to respond to the events, which are always changing, right? And ourselves, that's always changing. We're part of the changing events. Our cells in our body are dying and new ones are growing and so forth. So this practice of genuine reality, how do we find our way of doing that? I look forward to these 2 months of our looking together at how do we do this? And to our Shuso, we'll be speaking about this too, and we'll be having, for the people in the practice commitment period, there'll be discussion groups and of various kinds. And so anyway, it's a pleasure to be launching into this practice of genuine reality with all of you and the others in the practice period, and with everybody else who shows up here. So I'll stop and ask for comments or questions or responses from anyone. Please feel free. David.
Just kind of an announcement, really. I have an extra book I thought I had lost in mind. Purchase a second one. But I only have two. So if somebody needs one or wants to use it, just let me know. I'll be more happy to share it with you.
Great. Thank you for that. That's generous. If nobody claims it tonight, I'll send a message out to everyone in the practice. So any reflections or messages from genuine reality? Yes, Shuso.
I think you covered this in your talk, but I find that I think it comes up for people. We've been investigating these teachings in Albuquerque for a little while, and there's a lot of emphasis on curing or grinding down these apparent habits. And yet we live in this culture, well, and sort of emphasizing serenity and peaceableness. And these are wonderful teachings, but we live in a psychodramatical time and a psychological time. And I think many of us are prone to maybe dysfunction arising out of repression or unfelt stuff. And I think those things can come up during practice. So I don't know if maybe you could just expand your thoughts a little bit on how those things meet, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that I think Hongzhi, even back in the 12th century, addresses that part of how Buddhism has found its way in our culture is through Western psychology and through the insights of Western psychology and family dynamics and so forth. But you know, in this passage, in this section, excuse me, Hongzhi talks about not being possessed by emotions. Effectively overcoming habitual behavior. In the previous one, which was is the first in the whole practice instructions, he talks about purify, cure, grind down, and brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. So, of course, that's easier said than done, but he's recognizing. He's not saying to ignore. He's giving. He has four different modes of response to our patterns of behavior that can be obstructive, and so throughout these practice instructions, he talks about those kinds of patterns that are human obstructions. And talks about them in various ways. So I think we have to face, I think for many of us coming to practice, the most difficult part of developing a sustained practice, it's difficult to face. It's more difficult to face that stuff than, to get your legs in some funny position or whatever. How do we, recognize our own patterns of depression or anger or fear or, whatever. And I think the practice is to face that. And the precepts are about not repressing that, but seeing that and not... I talk about not reacting based on them. I don't know. Are other comments about this? I mean, a lot of you have worked with this, these issues. Yes, Chris.
I really like, I was reading Guy Newland's book, Introduction to Emptiness, and he used this word reify that I really liked. Because, for the greater part of my young adulthood, in terms of like using the phrase true reality, I feel like I was almost like victim to what I conceived reality to be, my thoughts, to me it seemed that my thoughts informed who I was. And then, you can have any kind of number of thoughts, nice ones, bad ones, violent ones, perverse ones, and they're all just products of karmic conditioning, what your parents told you, your friends told you, society's told you, mixed with emotion. I mean, it's really hard to see clearly in that sort of state of mind, so to speak. But just recently, it was sort of interesting. I had this experience where I could see how a feeling would arise, and then immediately my mind would try and reify that feeling by blaming it on some kind of external condition.
Right.
That I felt this way because this happened, and if I were to change it, it would feel this way, and then my mind will be satisfied. And seeing the constant pattern of how that goes to try and objectify a world that isn't solid or material or, well, it is material, but not seemingly in the way that we perceive it to be. So, it's sort of interesting because for a while I would have these thoughts and I would try and follow them to the end. to see if there was some kind of insight I could get from them, but then I just realized that it's just seeing the process of how the thought comes and then letting it go, because it's just, it's like, it took me a long time to really understand this, but when Uchiyama Roshi says that thoughts are just secretions of the brain,
yeah,
that's really interesting.
Yeah, and what you described is the our usual way of dealing with anger or sadness or whatever. We tend to blame something out there rather than acknowledging, oh, it's my anger, it's my sadness, but we want to find something out there that we can manipulate to fix it, and that's what we usually do, rather than just owning, oh yeah, I'm feeling this. This is so. Yeah, other comments. Yes, Ben.
So I'm struck, I mean, I'm picking up a little bit on this idea of reification. When he talks about that unhindered response, the metaphors that he's using are all metaphors that are about relationships between things. So mountains flowing, clouds flowing over a mountain, moonlight flowing over a landscape, parts of a box fitting together. So he's seeing that not as a thing that you have or a state that you acquire, but as processes between things that are doing different things, but they aren't like harming each other. They're according while their clouds are going up, the mountains are there, the moonlight is coming down.
So relationships.
Yeah, relationships and processes and not states or things.
Right. Yeah, processes, relationships, rather than something that you have to fix or destroy or whatever. Yes, Dave.
I'm kind of intrigued by the word serenity right now.
Cool.
I feel like, is it possible that it's like more of a determination rather than like a location, like not a place to get to? I always want to call everything practice, but I guess
determination is that?
A determination to like, or a steadfastness in practice. You know what I mean? Where it's like, it's not like I'm trying to get to serenity somewhere else, but it's sort of like willingness to engage with
the mud, you know, and like the finding,
knowing that there is peace in there,
and kind of like sitting with it. Yeah, that's interesting. So serenity is not some place somewhere else to get to. Serenity, determination is an interesting word. Serenity is a way of being, but it's, when you use the word determination, I think of intention, or it's a kind of posture or something. That's interesting. That's something to work with in the practice period. How do we express serenity? Or I'm not sure. That's an interesting
steadfastness.
Yeah. There's serenity involves a kind of. We will be chanting on many Monday nights the guidepost for serene illumination or silent illumination, which talks about serenity too. But what does it mean to engage or express serenity? I think that's an interesting question. Is it something that we decide on? I agree with you. It's not some other place. Somewhere else, but how do we? Yeah, what is it? that's interesting. Brian?
I was struck by maybe the first comment you made where you alluded to fake news, the term. And I thought about how all news is constructed narrative. And there's just some stories are more fake than others, perhaps. And Rev Anderson's phrase of that's the story I tell myself relates to. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, what is genuine reality then? And I was thinking, Chris, what you were saying about all the constructions of reality that we tend to live by and believe in. And maybe the practice is letting those dissipate. When they dissipate, or as they dissipate, general reality may be what's glimpsed or left when the constructed realities are lived. Just this.
Okay. That, yeah, that recalls the, there's a reference to it in one of the practice instructions to the Flower Ornament Sutra's wisdom. It's a case in the Book of Serenity referring to the Avatamsaka Sutra. The way Hongzhe says it is, amid living beings is the original place of nirvana. How amazing it is that all people have this but cannot polish it into bright clarity. In darkness unawakened, they make foolishness cover their wisdom and overflow. One remembrance of illumination can break through and leap out of the dust of kalpas. So that, you know, there's that, the idea is that the, that actually Hongzhe starts the practice instructions, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning, but we have these obstructions of foolishness and illusions that block our seeing that. And so that's sort of what you were saying, and so our practice is about cutting through that somehow. We're sitting long enough to let them dissipate, is another way of saying it. So.